Hey John,
Hey George,
how you
how
doing?
are you?
Welcome to the Breakfast Club.
It's good to be here.
Oh well, with the 2 hour difference, actually, it's not the Breakfast Club for you anymore.
Well, George, I gotta tell you, not to brag, but I just finished playing a morning game of hockey with a bunch of my buddies here in Cold
Wow.
Spring in Garrison.
Wow. I'm impressed.
Well, I feel really lucky to have played, and it's unusual for us to play on a Friday morning like this, but it's been so warm this winter
Yeah.
that we didn't get our first game in until last weekend, which is really unusual not to play until after New Year's. And it was warm all week, and so normally there are a bunch of guys who really don't like playing early morning games, but we decided to this morning. We all got out there at 9:30, which is very early for us, because it's probably going to be too soft, the ice, by
Wow.
this afternoon.
Boy, we're not having a problem in Santa Fe. It snowed a little last night, and there's still snow on the ground from when I think I talked to you a month ago.
We have had snow. We had a bunch of snow a while ago. In fact, if I may give you a little science-y version of hockey,
Yeah.
so what happened this year that actually screwed up the ice early on was that we had a cold spell, and just when the ice was freezing at all the ponds that we normally use, we got a bunch of snow. And so
Yeah.
all the ponds that had ice early got snow, and then when it got cold again, the snow is all crusty and you can't skate on those.
Oh, yeah.
So we had to send the troops out and search for a pond that had not frozen initially and had open water right through the snowfall, but then froze after that.
Oh,
And there was
okay.
only one pond in town, this pond called Lake Surprise, in North Cold Spring, that fulfilled those conditions, and we played there last weekend, and that's where we played this morning.
Oh, that sounds great. Wow. Well, I haven't done anything nearly that energetic. I've just been dreading the thought of having to shovel snow to get out of my house. Even though it's not very much snow, but it's the weird thing is that it's not melting. Usually here it'll snow in the winter and then it'll get into the 50s in a, the next day and then it'll all melt off, but it's turning into ice and accumulating.
Have you seen the New York Times this morning?
Oh yeah, Sarah Lyle had a story about kind of a roundup on extreme weather all over the world.
So I'm looking at my issue right now. I'll see if people can see this. It's a picture of a photograph
Yeah.
of Jerusalem with palm trees with snow all over
Isn't
them.
that
And
great? It's very striking.
the article is about, as you say, all these really crazy weather events, and it reminds me that there's some environmental activists who think that the term global warming should be replaced with global weirding.
Global weirding. Oh, so that's even beyond global climate change.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and the idea is that it's not just that things are going to get warm, which might sound pretty good to a lot of people, but we're
Yeah.
going to get more of these extreme, you get more energy injected into the
Right.
atmosphere, and that is just going to create more extreme weather events like Sandy, the big storm that hit the Northeast last fall, and
Yeah.
snow in Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, or we're just getting a year full of black swans, as Taleb would call them.
Yeah, where are you, George? I mean, how do you?
Well, again, it's that dilemma. You can't take any one event, and trace it to changes in the global climate. But when you start getting these patterns, but how many years of patterns? I mean, how many years until the pattern is established? And
Well, you probably also saw it was mentioned in this piece in the Times that 2012 was the warmest year
yeah.
ever recorded in the not globally. I don't know if those
But
figures are
yeah, the
in yet,
United
but
States.
in the
Yeah.
United States.
But it wasn't in Santa Fe at all. We had a pretty pretty, you know, relatively cool summer. On the other hand, we've had like two summers in a row when we just essentially didn't get our usual rainy season. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's really, you know, it would be really hard to maintain much skepticism when you get this many extreme events all over the world. But then again, you don't really know.
You know, just going back, if I may use the my hockey season as a data point. Last year, there was only one pond that stayed frozen for the whole season. It was the only place that we could play. Yeah. Normally, we're just moving around from pond to pond, and it was the pond with the highest elevation in this whole area of Putnam County. It froze early, and it stayed frozen, and we had a good 2 months.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of the other ponds where we play never got cold enough to skate on. So it was kind of a little bit of an omen there, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to see a story. Maybe there's been stories that I've missed, but something like with Sarah's story this morning, looking at the, you know, extreme weather roundup all over the world for the last year or so, and then going back and, I mean, has there been any isolated years like that in the past? And that would be interesting if there were. But then if there were like two or three of these in a row, you know, I don't see how you could maintain much skepticism. But
can I just ask you something, kind of a personal question?
Yeah.
How do you know there are these? We've talked about this a little bit before, but I actually don't remember if you answered this question or if you really said what you believe personally, as opposed to talking about the science. What's your gut feeling about whether humanity is really facing possible extinction or some terrible, terrible calamity as a result of climate change, you know, if we keep going on the course that we're on now?
My gut feeling, like deep down inside my reptilian brain.
Yeah, so, you know, Bill McKibben and James Hansen and Lester Brown and some people like that are saying the sky is falling, basically.
Right.
And nobody gives a shit, you know?
Yeah, we have to
and
start wake up people. Earth two days.
Yeah.
No, my gut level feeling is that it's not going to happen and it's going to be this gradual thing and we'll adapt to it. But I rush to add that that's based entirely on just my gut feeling and probably has more to do with my basic personality, and it's definitely not based on the science. But my gut feeling, if you cut through the rational layers, no, I don't believe anything horrible is going to happen. But
now,
I also don't believe that the United States will become like a third or fourth rate world power, or that you know, we'll be all speaking Chinese in 10 or 100 years. But, you know, none of this is based on any rational instincts. It's just kind of this general assumption that things will remain pretty much the same. And I guess I'm a gradualist rather than a catastrophist.
Yeah. Now imagine that you had lived through, you'd lived in New Orleans when Katrina hit, or you had a beautiful yeah. little cottage in Far Rockaway.
Yeah.
When Sandy hit,
yeah.
and you know there are people whose homes were destroyed who are still homeless.
Oh,
I wonder if that would
I think
it would too.
Yeah, no, this is totally based on being pretty lucky in that regard. I mean, I'm seeing things that affect me in the sense of, you know, we're getting, like when I first moved back to New Mexico in 1992, you know, we were typically getting 12 to 14 inches of precipitation a year. You know, mm-hmm. now we're lucky to get 8, which used to be what you'd get down in Albuquerque, which is much drier. You know, and the result is that, you know, trees are dying and, you know, I'm having to water things from the water hydrant a lot more than I normally would have, because I have things that are, you know, they're drought tolerant, xeriscape kind of plantings, but even those, you know, they won't do with zero water. So
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at now, and I just heard a story about it on NPR yesterday. I'm looking at a picture of all these dead sheep on what looks like scorched earth. Oh, it is scorched earth. It was from a bushfire in in Canberra, and this region of Africa and of Australia that has historically been quite dry, but is now extremely dry.
Yeah.
And there is a life-threatening drought there, and a terrible high risk of fires. And what I heard, it's apocalyptic there. It's, you know, it's like Mad Max.
Wow.
Definitely
other places are getting much more extreme.
Yeah,
extreme weather than we are here. You know, speaking specifically in Santa Fe, but you know that could change. So
yeah,
maybe it's my fearfulness that this will happen that it's making me kind of retreat into this this feeling that things will tend to march along and just gradually change. But you know, again, this is not rational. But
it doesn't mean that it's right
or wrong.
I don't know if it is possible to be totally irrational when you're looking at the future. I don't even know if it's appropriate. And after all, our emotional reactions to different scenarios and forecasts and so forth can shape our responses and alter the future.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we all despair and we're fatalistic, we say, I don't give a shit what happens. I'm just going to try to, you know, party down and have a good time before the end comes, or if the end comes. You know, that's one route. Or if you get all excited and try to motivate yourself and motivate other people to, I don't know, put in giant seawalls in New York Harbor or something.
Yeah.
But I feel like my own attitude towards some of these environmental issues really is so emotional.
Yeah.
And I think it's true of most people as well. And I don't know if you can tease apart the emotions from the lines of evidence so much.
Yeah, it's hard. And then, you know, I mean, there's obviously nothing bad environmentally that would happen by spewing less carbon into the atmosphere and by, you know, gradually moving from fossil fuels to other kinds of energy. So, you know, the result of that kind of fear would be good and, you know, may, you know, slow down the effects of global warming. But as they say, you know, I guess the predictions generally are that it's too late to, you know, stop or reverse the effect, but maybe to make it less severe. So all those things are good. And then, you know, of course, there's the counter argument. What would that do to the economy? And
how do you
make China do that and all of this? But, yeah, I mean, so I guess to me it's all good reasons to be doing things that we should be doing in any case. And
I'd like to I hope this isn't too artificial a segue, but I've got a terrific speaker coming to my school this exactly a week from when we're speaking now. Friday, January 18th. And so I wanted to put a plug in case anybody out there in Blogging Heads world wants to come. Jared Diamond, the great. I don't know what he is. He calls himself a geographer. If he's a geographer, I don't know any other geographers.
Well, yeah, his academic appointment is in geography, but he's also medical, as well as, you know, and of course, you know, he's by all measures, an anthropologist, even though anthropologists kind of bristle at him in some of his writings. But he's just one amazing writer of fascinating, just unbelievably, you know, important books.
Yeah, he's one of these scientists, scholars. He's really a polymath who kind of
impressive. Yeah, a polymath.
Yeah, he stands on top of the mountain and looks out across the grand sweep of human history.
Yeah.
And all the enormous variety of human cultures from these tribal societies in New Guinea, where he's been going for about 40 years, right up to Los Angeles, where he teaches at UCLA, and extracts all these insights and lessons that can be applied to the modern world.
Yeah, and I, you know, I mean, I as a fellow writer of nonfiction books, you know, I really admire what he does. But you know, there's a huge, well, not huge, but there's a definite backlash from people in the anthropological community, or I hate that word, among anthropologists, you know, who really feel like he overreaches and, you know, cherry picks his information to support these themes. And I don't really agree with this, but I think we've talked before about this meeting I went to a few years ago, and it was basically a Jared Diamond bashing session.
I remember that.
Yeah, these anthropologists who'd come from various parts of the country and all converged in the wonderful little town, although it's not really a town, of Dragoon, Arizona. You know, right, you know, where the thing is, when you see those signs driving out west that say 192 miles to the thing. The thing is in Dragoon, Arizona, and we all met there, and they were really just going after Jared Diamond, you know, first for his book Guns, Germs, and Steel, and then for his book Collapse. And I found it an interesting sociological phenomenon, how they were reacting to him, and how, you know, what he does well, which is to kind of, you know, gloss over the distracting details and step back and blur your vision a little, and, you know, get this big picture and lessons and, you know, sweeping ideas. To them, this was this really bad thing, and they would talk about the importance of taking a phenomena or an idea and complexifying it.
So right.
And I realized they were using the word complexify something as in a positive way. Well, to me, simplifying would be the positive term. And then it got into all this kind of interesting, you know, sort of postmodern interpretations. And I'll put a link to my article, since we already talked about this years ago.
Yeah, I remember that. I started, by the way, I was just holding up the cover of Diamond's new book, which I'm just reading now. It's called The World Until Yesterday, and it's very much of a piece with Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse. In this particular book, Diamond is looking very carefully at what he calls traditional societies. You know, it's not cool to use the term primitive these days. Traditional societies, tribal societies, pre-state societies. I guess even pre-state is sort of frowned upon because it sounds like, you know, these are societies that haven't matured enough to create states. But he's looking at all these different cultures, especially in New Guinea because he's so familiar with that, but also in South America and Australia. Africa, I think a couple in Asia, and trying to say, well, let's look at what they do. You know, in a way, you can see these all as different experiments in human existence, and human values and behaviors and so forth, and the ways that men and women live together, and the way that they raise their children, and the way that people resolve disputes, and the way that people take care of themselves in terms of their health, their diets, and so forth. And what do these other societies do that we would want to avoid? And what do they do that we might want to emulate?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, similar to what he did in Collapse. This book is just a little more personal. He's got a lot of stories based on his own first-person experiences in New Guinea. And, you know, I looked at some reviews online already. The reviews are coming out right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was one really vicious review by an anthropologist named Wade Davis.
Oh, Wade Davis, He's the one who wrote about zombies, right, in Haiti?
Yeah, and he wrote a great book about trekking after hallucinogenic plants. It was kind of a biography of this great ethnobotanist named Richard Schultes, who discovered a lot of hallucinogenic plants. And but it was also like a memoir about Wade Davis's adventures and going off in the jungle and getting stoned out of his mind.
Oh, well, this was right up your alley.
It was definitely right up my alley. I used it as a source for rational mysticism.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And he wrote a review of Diamond's new book that made it sound as though Diamond was kind of this relic of Victorian-era science who's got this ranking of societies from the primitive traditional ones at the bottom, hunter-gatherers, up to modern industrialized technological civilizations.
And, yeah.
And that Diamond is kind of politically correct, but there's still this implicit hierarchy in there. And I think it's bullshit. It just seemed to be, the review seemed to come from this personal animus.
Yeah.
And it was in a way, I thought Davis was portraying the book, describing a book that was the opposite of the book that Diamond actually wrote.
Well, you know, this sounds like what I was running into, you know, after this conference, because that was just after Collapse had come out. And so the big complaint there was that, let me back up. So first they also, took Guns, Germs, and Steel. And to me, I mean, the message of that book was that, basically we shouldn't feel so smug that civilization developed, or what we call civilization, in the Fertile Crescent, and that Western Europe and the United States have these, very advanced industrial civilizations and all this, scientific achievement. And, while Africa does not, or certainly not Southern Africa, or, pick any place in the world, Papua New Guinea. And then Diamond's message was, well, this all could be explained by accidents of geography, being in certain parts of the planet that were, more hospitable to agriculture, and then to have the trade winds favor shipping routes, and that all for environmental accidental contingencies. You could explain why this happened here and not, say, in around the southern tip of Africa. So just a profoundly anti-racist kind of message, just saying, we could have thrown the dice a little differently, and if we'd done Sim Earth and come up with slightly different parameters for the planet and a different geography. I mean, there he was being the ultimate geographer. This may well all have happened, somewhere near the site of, modern day Senegal or something. But then this got this backlash from the anthropologists who said, Diamond's being an environmental determinist.
Environmental determinist, right?
Yeah, real fighting words among among anthropologists or among certain schools of anthropologists. And this was the old way of thinking, that people were pawns of their environment and you weren't looking at them as rational human beings, and you're acting like people were just buffeted around by the elements and couldn't think and decide. So then it was almost like Collapse was consciously or probably unconsciously a reaction to that. And there he's showing how these societies, really screwed up their environments and led to some kind of environmental catastrophe. And he had that amazing chapter where he compared what happened in Haiti and what didn't happen in the Dominican Republic. And, just sharing the same island. And, there he was showing that, the environment can, be a factor, but it also involves in people making good decisions and bad decisions. And he gave examples of societies making good decisions. And the classic thing about Easter Island and cutting down the last tree to move these giant stone heads for their religion. And, You know, so then, you know, this was kind of, you know, looking at the other side, another big sweeping picture. And this, and then they were bashing this because now he was blaming the victims. It was like, you know, these societies like Haiti, all these horrible things have happened. And instead of, you know, blaming, you know, colonial imperialism and things, we're blaming the poor Haitians. So it was kind of like damned if you do and damned if you don't. First, he's an environmental determinist, and then he's putting too much blame on people's deliberate decisions, and this was all tied in with them, you know, disputing his examples and saying he left out various factors, and maybe they didn't make such bad decisions, and that they didn't have as much, as wide a parameters of choice in deciding things like, you know, how to do timber harvesting. So anyway, so now this book comes out, which it seems just from, I read the one review, David Brooks has a review coming out in the Times this Sunday, and that's already out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
great choice for a reviewer, actually.
Yeah, he basically, he really liked the book and the ideas, but then he was, he thought that Diamond didn't bring out the people enough and that it was very clinical, and he didn't really get a feel for the Papua New Guineans, and that was his criticism, but not the ideas. But then this book is kind of like, it almost seems to me like it could be taken as a reaction to the reaction to collapse now, because,
right,
you know, now he's showing all these good decisions that these different societies made, and all these things that we can learn from so-called primitive societies. And
so yeah.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
I think maybe this is the inevitable cost of enormous success for someone who is a very serious intellectual. You know, Diamond, I think, is in a category along with Ed Wilson and Steve Pinker and maybe, I don't know, Niall Ferguson, people like that, and who are, have had a lot of success as academics and within a field of scholarship, but then also enormous popular success. And there's got to be, and especially when you're holding forth on human nature and human history and making statements about where we should go from here, you're going to get a lot of backlash. But to me, he's, I really admire, I mean, I could quibble with certain things. I've found some things in his book that I might fault him for, and when he talks about the origins of war and so forth, one of my obsessions.
Well, but yeah, he's got a different idea on that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. But overall, the book is another great work. It was just chock full of fascinating information and insights, both from Diamond's reading and from his personal knowledge of places like New Guinea.
It's really what you want, right? I mean,
yeah, and both. Coming up,
you want someone making the big sweeping theories and the big ideas and, standing back and looking at the big picture, and then you want other people like coming in and chipping away at this and saying, well, it wasn't quite this way. And, so you get this corrective, but, I guess it's true that the public, gets the first and not the second. And then some of the complaint was that, the public was not, was being misled. But, to me, a book like this, people don't take it as like, he's preaching the gospel. He's giving a really interesting organizing, principles, and then making sense of a lot of things that otherwise don't seem to make sense. And then you can read it and read it critically. And
Anyway, I'm glad Jared Diamond is coming to Stevens.
It's great.
And, the lecture is open to all. So next Friday, January 18th, 5 o'clock, Stevens campus. You can go online and get all the information you want.
You've been getting an amazing lineup of speakers.
By the way, I've got Lawrence. This is kind of in some ways it's surprising. My attitude is I bring in speakers who have really interesting things to say and have a history of grabbing people's attention, but are, above a certain threshold of seriousness. And in April, Lawrence Krauss is going to come to Stevens.
Oh, great.
And talk about whether science has solved the riddle of why there is something rather than nothing.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, he really thinks I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say, I mean, we've talked about his work. I've given him a really hard time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was really pissed off at me, and we crossed swords. We had a kind of pissing match on the Scientific American.
Right.
And then I thought, what the hell? I should bring him to my school, show their no hard feelings, and I'm sure the students will love him.
Oh, yeah. So.
And so I asked him if he'd come, and he's coming in April.
Oh, that'll be great. That'll be great. Yeah. I'd love to hear the debate. I mean,
I don't know. I'm not gonna. You know, I'm just gonna let him say his thing. I might ask an obnoxious question.
Yeah, I mean, just for our listeners that haven't been following it, Lawrence Krauss wrote this book that the book that really made him the most famous was called The Physics of Star Trek.
Right.
And he's written a number of other books of popular science. I reviewed one not too long ago, like you did a new mini biography of Richard Feynman. Uh-huh. You know, and the angle was that it was written from the point of view of another physicist, Larry Krauss, who had really admired Feynman. And then in his new book, he's making the argument that he's basically saying that the last argument of the theists against the atheists really doesn't hold up, which is to say, well, science can explain maybe everything about the physical natural world, but science can never explain why there is something instead of nothing, and where it all came from. And then he purports to explain this, in a way with a similar flavor to like Hawking and Hartle's, what is it called, no boundary.
Yeah.
No boundary, boundary, and, the universe bootstrapping it into existence, and, and it's all consistent with mathematical field theory. But, my big beef with that is it presupposes not just mathematical field theory, but it presupposes mathematics. So you're still left to explain where mathematics came from.
Yes. As like Andre Linde was one of my favorite theoretical physicists. He's one of the inventors of cosmic inflationary theory.
Right.
And he used to say the universe came from quantum fluctuation. Quantum fluctuation. That's basically what, because the quantum mechanics says that everything is sort of jumping. There are only probabilities of different things existing and behaving in certain ways. And so all these sort of probable things are popping in and out of existence, and that one of these virtual possibilities suddenly became real, and hence the universe.
Yeah, which is all well and good, but then where did this this quantum cauldron come from in the first place? So
yeah,
and you have
so
to
maybe.
Pretty, I mean, it's just maybe, logically, you can't step out of the system of the universe and explain the whole thing. There's always an edge where you have to stop and say, it's just what it is. And so there's always a room if you want to take the Kierkegaardian leap and embrace, some kind of theism, some kind of religion. And some of us don't choose to do that, but and those who do are left explaining why Roman Catholicism or why Tibetan Buddhism or why the flying spaghetti monster, or why, this particular religion or not. And, and I can't go there, but I definitely can go with the idea that there's this wall, and beyond that is the ultimate mystery, and we'll never know.
Well, George, I forget if we've talked about it. I know I've mentioned it, but I forget if I went into detail about the book by Jim Holt.
You reviewed that, right?
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of it. It's sort of,
basically, why is there something instead of nothing, why does the world exist, or
why does the world exist? Something like that. It was the Times named it one of its 10 favorite books.
Right.
of the year. And Holt kind of wanders around and talks to all these philosophers and scientists about and asks them this question, why there's something rather than nothing. And a bunch of them were people that that I have spoken to. But what really surprised me is that there are some people, there's a philosopher at University of Pittsburgh, I think, named Adolf Grumbaum. And I knew him as a he's a ferocious critic of psychoanalysis, but he's also talked about theoretical physics. And he finds the question, why there's something rather than nothing, to be meaningless. He doesn't think it's a big deal that anything exists. And I find that it's like one of us is colorblind, I think. I think it's Grumbaum who's colorblind.
Yeah.
But he obviously thinks that I'm kind of colorblind.
Well, it's kind of refreshing to hear someone say that because, you know, whatever people's ideas about, you know, what the answer to the question might be or whether it's answerable, it's kind of refreshing to
like, big fucking deal.
Someone say, yeah, it's no big deal, you know.
Which, who cares?
I mean, it depends on, you know, so you could, I mean, I guess he means more than just, well, we can't possibly know anyway, you know, and, you know, whatever, whatever is that is, we're, you know, stuck with it and can try to explain it. But, wow, that's interesting. Well, I saw that Dyson, Freeman Dyson reviews Holt's book in the New York Review of Books currently.
Yeah, and somebody tweeted it, and I saw a line, tweeted a line from Dyson, and he called... I think he said that modern philosophers as a whole are I think he said, intellectual dwarfs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're going to love that. So, which is kind of the sort of, it's kind of what Lawrence Krauss was saying in his book, too.
Yeah, and Stephen Hawking said it. There's been a lot of bashing of.
Oh, yeah, and Murray Gell-Mann here in Santa Fe just, you know, loves to, you know, bash philosophers. And yeah, that's right. In fact, come to think of it, that's how I found out about the Dyson article, because I saw your tweet.
Oh, okay, right.
Wow, God. So this, they're actually, you know, you do get something out of this Twitter stuff, even though I'm still, I don't think I don't think I've tweeted for, you know, since before Christmas.
Well, obviously, I always thought it was kind of a long shot that you would become a serious tweeter. It takes a certain degree of obsessive compulsion.
Yeah, and I don't know, I just feel like I'm already getting these, you know, my book is going to be published later this year, and I'm already getting these new, like there's this Random House newsletter for authors, and like every edition that comes into my email has something about, you know, advice on using Twitter and Instagram, important new way to do something to do with pictures. And I just groan when I look at this, but I know that I'm trying to slowly wade into this. But then I, every once in a while, you know, a big wave comes and I run to shore. And but anyway, if anyone out there wants to follow me, I'd really appreciate it because I got to get some followers because, you know, at this point, this is weird. You know, I got an email from someone and they said they saw my, you know, my next book, it's called The Cancer Chronicles. Mm-hmm. And the subtitle is Unlocking Medicine's Deepest Mystery.
Nice.
And it's not coming out until August. And just now I'm going through the copy edit of the manuscript, you know, so it's been through, you know, my editor, John Siegel at Knopf, and then they send it out to a contract copy editor who, and I have to say, I just got a superb copy editor. It's just the best I've ever gotten for a book. Mm-hmm. And like my last one was one of the worst. So it's just really, really, really smart, brilliant copy editing. But anyway, so I'm going through this, and I get an email from someone saying that my book is on Amazon, and I look, and you know, it's already, they have a page for it with a picture of the cover art.
Wow.
They haven't figured out that I'm the same George Johnson that wrote the other books that they have on Amazon, because if you click on my name, you just get every George Johnson. But I guess they'll figure that out at some point. But
Yeah.
I was just surprised at how far in advance this all happens now.
Yeah. God, that's exciting, George. Can't wait. Can't wait to read it.
Yeah, it's not till August.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty quick. That's pretty quick.
Well, you know, one thing, this is like, what's been your recent experience? Like, this will be my 9th book, and it's the first time that the copy edit came back to me electronically and not, you know, as hundreds of pages in an envelope with colored pencil marks and little colored paper tabs glued on with queries for the author.
Shit, I can't. No, mine was electronic. So, yeah, it was McSweeney's, and we did it all electronically.
Wow, this is the first for me, and it's, I don't know, I kind of miss the paper in some ways, except, God, it's so changed. I mean, when I got the copy edit manuscript back for Strange Beauty, my biography of Murray Gell-Mann, mm-hmm. it smelled like an ashtray. It was so horrible, just reeking with cigarette smoke. Like, as soon as I opened the envelope, and this is like the longest book I've written, I think. So this is this huge thing, and I had to keep it outside. Fortunately, it came during the summer because it was a fall book or early or late spring. So I kept it outside on this portal outside my office, and then I went to the auto parts store and got something you sprayed in the interior of cars to get out cigarette smoke. So I would I would flip through the pages and kind of give it a light spray, and then I would go out and take in the chapter's worth of pages, and then I could just feel the nicotine rubbing off into my, you know, I sent my editor an email saying that I didn't realize that I needed to request a non-smoking copy editor.
I have never heard of that. You know, it's too bad that with some books, that would probably put you in the right mood. Like if you had written a biography of Charles Bukowski or something,
yeah,
and you get the manuscript back and it stinks like cigar smoke and scotch. You know,
that's true. It could be part of the experience, and then they would figure out how to. You'd have scratch and sniff put in the bound copies of the book for people to buy.
I never have had that problem of a smelly manuscript.
I mean, I'm surprised that doesn't happen all the time, because I imagine your typical freelance copy editor, like, living in a really dark apartment somewhere in Manhattan and, you know, having lots of cats. And I rush to say that I don't think of my current copy editor like that at all. She's really, really smart and has made many improvements.
Yeah. Well, that's congratulations. 9 books, man, you're so far ahead of me. I do have to say, I just printed out a complete manuscript of a new book last week. So I'm going through marking it up and creating a new draft as we speak.
Excellent. I didn't know this.
Yeah, it's very peculiar kind of memoirish. I don't want to say too much about it because it's so weird. It's probably gonna die quietly, and it'll be too embarrassing if I talk about it. And then
I doubt that, but
it never gets published.
Wow! As soon as you're ready to talk about it, I'd love to hear more.
Yeah. Well, let me just put it this way: it was inspired in part by my reading of Ulysses last summer. So, probably bad to come up with a book idea after reading the greatest novel ever written. But,
tweeting Ulysses.
Yeah, right.
Oh no, that sounds great. Wow.
Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, it was fun because End of War was such a difficult book to write.
Oh, yeah,
and,
I know.
It was like torture every word. I just, always was second guessing myself, and this book just came out and just sort of
just really flowed, huh?
Yeah,
that's a great feeling. That hardly ever happens.
Yeah,
I mean, it might happen like for a chapter or two, and then you hit this wall where you're just squeezing it out, and
yeah,
you can always tell later when you read your own book, you know, the really best right. chapters were the ones that were the most effortless.
Yep. Yeah. There's such a thing as grace in writing, I guess.
Yeah, when it happens, and the damn thing is, the damnedest thing is you have to do it whether the grace comes or not. And,
yep. If you're a professional, you got that deadline. Yeah. Somebody's paying you some serious cash.
You can't
be like think you're like Coleridge or someone sort of waiting for the inspiration to hit.
Yeah, especially if you have to make a living off of it.
Yeah, well, you've done amazingly well. So, well, listen, we got 15 minutes left.
Yeah, what else were we gonna delve into?
Well, there's a piece that I just wrote for Scientific American. And it's kind of related to tweeting and some of the other stuff we're just talking about. It was inspired by a couple of different articles that I read recently, and also by something that my son showed me online. My son is someone who helps me keep up with cyber culture.
Ah.
So this was something that the New York Times has also covered. There's this town called Steubenville, Ohio.
Oh.
And I read
what you wrote. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, it's a football crazy town, and at the end of the summer, a lot of the football players on the high school team, which is very successful, had a big party. There were also non-football players there, and there was apparently a girl from a nearby town who got really intoxicated at the party, and pretty much passed out. She was incapacitated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were some boys who were doing really awful things to her and thinking it was funny. Mm. And then other people are taking taking videos and snapshots with their cell phones and posting it on Instagram.
Rape, basically?
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid that, but that term, at this point you've got to assume alleged and reportedly and so forth.
But
bad things happened to this girl, and she didn't even remember the next day. But then word gets around the town. There are these pictures of her online, and a boy's doing bad things to her, and so her parents go to the police and report it, and the police actually arrested two kids, stars of the high school football team in Steubenville, and charged them with rape and also kidnapping initially, because they were stuffing the girl in their car and driving her around to different places.
Oh my God!
And so the boys were arrested, but then meanwhile there were lots of other people who were apparently standing around and just making jokes and taking pictures and so forth, and didn't do anything to stop what was obviously a crime. Or at the least something, a horrible thing that just should violate basic human decency.
Yeah.
And what happened was, what my son told me about was that the group Anonymous got involved. Now, Anonymous is this online collective of kind of vigilante hackers. It's related to WikiLeaks. It came into prominence as a result of the WikiLeaks affair, when people started harassing Julian Assange. Anonymous was sticking up for him and harassing some people who they saw as harassing Julian Assange. Anyway, Anonymous, or a branch of it called NightSec, started posting information about this incident in Steubenville, and threatening to expose all these other people who were involved, allegedly, including adults who covered it up, supposedly, if these people didn't come forward.
Yeah.
And the deadline was January 1st. And so that deadline came and went. And now Anonymous has posted, this group, NightSec, has posted all this information, detailed information, about all these different kids who were at these parties, and about some adults who apparently, they posted material about people in the officials in the school, about law enforcement officials who supposedly weren't vigorous enough in trying to charge people for participating in this group crime.
Mm.
And it kind of, for me, you know, I've written in the past about how maybe as a result of all these information technology, cell phones and so forth spreading through the world, we'll get this kind of grassroots spying network
mm-hmm.
that will root out injustice and whether it's on the part of powerful corporations or governments or even ordinary criminals, and that this can help make the world a safer place.
So we all become big brothers, you know, a brotherhood of big brothers.
Yeah.
Or little brothers. And yeah, okay, I could see making an idealistic argument.
And so this, for that, here it is. Yeah, here it is. It's the vigilante justice in practice. And I had mixed feelings. I on the one hand, I thought, because it really did look like there were a lot of people who were getting away with doing something really bad in this town. On the other hand, you don't know if the information that NightSec is posting is really reliable.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, just your description is so vivid, I was immediately thinking, wow, yeah, you know, this is horrible. And, you know, probably something horrible did happen, but, you know, we do have this justice system.
Right.
However imperfect it is. So, yeah, so how is this different from them deciding just to go burn their houses down or lynch them up? So it's not, they're not taking violence against them in the physical world. And at worst, they're being defamed, but truth is the ultimate defense for libel. But we don't know it's true.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it would depend to me somewhat on the pictures and how definitive that seems to be.
You can see some really bad shit online. If you go, you look at some of the links on my piece that I posted on Scientific American, you can see some stuff that will really freak you out. Yeah. Definitely bad things happen there.
Yeah, so in that case, but
I think it's a really interesting trend. It's something worth watching. It wasn't the way that NightSec did it. It looked like they were trying to be fairly responsible. They were definitely taking very seriously what they were doing. It wasn't jokey. It wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't a prank.
Yeah. But was it definitely clear that the local law enforcement was really not going to do anything about this?
Well, in the New York Times article, the chief sheriff, I think it was, said, "Listen, I think it's really bad that all these other people were watching and no one intervened, and if anything, they were joking about it on Twitter and so forth."
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what can we do if people don't come forward?
Yeah, and, so no one was coming forward. But how about the girl? I mean, you said she couldn't remember.
She couldn't remember anything.
What had happened, but there must have been, like, physical
evidence. She took a shower, and so there was no, semen or DNA evidence.
She doesn't want to prosecute.
No, she does.
Oh, she does. Oh, okay.
Well, yeah, as I said.
She can't get witnesses to come forward.
Well, there are these two boys who I'm not sure. I think they're out on bail now. Who were arrested because some of the pictures seemed to show them doing things that clearly counted as, I don't know, sexual assault or even rape.
Yeah.
So the question is, all these other people who were involved, and whether or not there was an attempt to cover up.
Yeah, but the police can't just depend on people's goodwill if they have. I mean, it sounds to me like they have probable cause to bring charges.
Yeah.
Just based on this material. So if they're not doing that, you know, makes me very much more sympathetic to the vigilante effort. And
yeah, I just wanted to mention one other thing that's in my piece that in a way is kind of, it's not as serious as this, but I think it points to a really interesting and in some ways kind of creepy potential trend in information technologies. So these would be the these little lightweight cameras that you can mount on your head. Google Glasses will be coming out soon, which have little tiny cameras that that can record everything that you see and also can post information about. And so a lot of this was inspired by Gordon Bell and the life logging project that he's been involved in. Gordon Bell is this computer industry pioneer, and I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so, he just started recording everything in his life and creating this gigantic digital file. Well, this has kind of caught on now.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a really interesting article in Esquire, and I talked about it in the same blog post that I talked about the Steubenville incident. This writer gets this little tiny camera that's mounted just above his ear, and he wears it for a few weeks just, you know, in the course of the day. And when he's hanging out at home with his wife and kid and meeting friends for drinks and so forth, and he talks about the effect it had on his life. And a couple of things that stood out. One is he and his wife had a really nasty argument, and it just sounded so typical, you know, as a recently divorced guy. I've had arguments like this.
Yeah.
Each one thought that the other had ordered food to be delivered. And so the food doesn't show up and they're looking at each other. Well, where's the food? I thought you ordered it. And no, I thought you ordered it. And then they start yelling at each other.
Oh, but this guy has his little camera on his head.
And he says, all right, geez. I know you're wrong and I'm right. Let's play the camera. Let's play the video back.
Yeah.
And it turned out that she had kind of misremembered it. It's a little bit vague, but she was more wrong than he was.
Oh, God.
And he was triumphant and said, "See, I told you." And she basically said, "Fuck you, you asshole."
Yeah, this sounds really stupid.
Yeah, how dare you do that? And, you know, like, now we have to have the argument all over again. You don't care about my feelings.
So I don't know, was the Esquire article trying to make the point that this is going to become this common phenomenon where we're all going to have these little real-time records of every second of our lives? I mean, I don't think this is going to happen. You know, my prediction is it's this quirky thing that two or three people will do to draw attention to themselves and maybe get book contracts and then nothing will ever come of it. Because who would want to do this?
It's a good question. I think as the technology gets really cheap and easy, that it will become, I think I can certainly imagine it going through a faddish phase where a lot of people start doing it. And listen, it doesn't have to be everyone for it to become a huge influence in our lives. If just a lot of people around you are wearing these things.
Because
he also talked about he's meeting friends, and they're gossiping in the way that people do, and suddenly they go, "Oh shit, are you recording this?" And he goes, "Yeah," and they go, "Damn it, okay, sorry, I'm not going to talk anymore unless you turn that thing off."
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, I mean,
but then people just forgot about it after a while.
They get used to it. Yeah, but he could do this with like a hidden microphone or something. It's kind of interesting. It's interesting that human memory is so unreliable that you'll tell people things that they'll remember and not consider this a threat, you know, like gossip. But at the same time, if they have this electronic device that actually records the voice signals, you know, this is considered then a threat because it's reliable. At least it's reliable in the sense that you can play back the signal and then recreate the message. But, yeah, that's sort of interesting in a weird philosophical way.
I can imagine it being used by journalists. I can imagine it being used by lawyers, by doctors, by people who are trying to protect them. I mean, listen, it's kind of, you've already got this being used by police and routine stops and so forth. I can imagine it being used for professional reasons.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Very broadly, and then seeping over into people's personal lives in the same way that Twitter and Facebook.
Oh, that's what'll happen. Yeah, there'll be plugins for Twitter.
Yeah.
So, you know, now it's this real inconvenience. I mean, you know, first there was this blogging thing where you actually had to sit down and come up with, you know, a few paragraphs. And, you know, and that was really, really hard. So then they come up with Twitter where it's limited to 140 characters or less. But you still have to do it. You know, it's really a drag to have to do things. So now, you know, it'll just be hooked up to your head, and you'll just have this constant real-time feed into something equivalent to Twitter. And you can, like, follow 1,000 people and then have all these little screens showing everything they're doing at every moment of their day and with the sound. I mean, does that sound, you know, like the most horrible thing or what?
And actually, you know, they're precursors of this. They go way back. I mean, you had people on the internet who had a room cam, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I was one of those.
You were?
No, I actually pointed mine out the window. But
right.
Yeah, once I did have one aimed at my desk, and I took a video of me working on a story, you know, for the Times, and then I sped it up to super high speed, and I just showed this once at a talk I gave on journalism, just kind of for fun. But yeah, no, I wasn't really a room person.
See, George, you're a pioneer. George, the funny thing about you, you're always portraying yourself as this grouchy old Luddite deploring the rush of humanity into the future, and yet there you are, a pioneer in self-video blogging.
Yeah, well, I was an early adopter of all of this stuff. And that's, yeah. I guess, partly what annoys me is it used to be this thing, you know, you'd go to a fair amount of work to do this, and you'd have to, you know, you'd have to do some, you know, a lot of tweaking and things and write little, you know, Unix shell scripts to do things and, you know, these cameras weren't ubiquitous like they are now, so you'd have to find, like, a good Ethernet camera. And so it was really fun when no one else or very few other people were doing it. And then, you know, just when it went mainstream, like everything else mainstream, I just started recoiling against it.
That's funny. There is a class of scientists who, Noam Chomsky is one, there are a few, because I've actually written about this before. There are some scientists who come up with a brilliant idea nobody's thought of before, and then as soon as everybody, all these other people start agreeing with them and saying this idea is fabulous, they turn around and say, I decided that idea is stupid. And then they move on to something else.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I can identify with that.
Yeah, you're one of them, George.
Yeah, well, except it's the journalistic version of that, I guess.
Yeah, and there you are asking for Twitter followers. I don't know, a little bit of a contradiction there.
Well, yeah, I know, but you know, it's one of these things where, you know, the more followers you have, the more incentive you have to. Have to use the technology.
Hey, listen, I'm over 700 now, so I only have like 120,000 to go to catch up to Carl Zimmer.
Hey, you have how many?
700.
700. Hey, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I'm up to. No, I passed 250 recently.
Uh huh. Yeah, you're doing great, you know.
Also, so followers, please flock to both of us, and I think our I think our Twitter addresses are on the Blogging Heads website. And
have you gotten any sex spam followers?
No.
Yeah, I've gotten a few prostitutes. At least I don't know if you. I actually. Oh, look
wait,
at the
I think maybe I did. You. Yeah, there was someone that it just didn't seem plausible that she was interested in. And following me for my pronouncements about science journalism, and then and then I think she disappeared shortly after that. It was probably some kind of crackdown.
Yeah. Hey, George, we're
oh, we're over an hour. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. It was good to talk to you. I'm not sure what we talked about exactly, but
the usual.
It was fun. So
the usual roaming around in circles in the wilderness.
And we'll do it again in approximately a month.
Yeah, sounds good, man.
You can tell me what Jared Diamond was like.
Okay, I will.
Sounds good, John.
All right. Take it easy, George.
Bye.